Hitler's Last Will and Testament. These two documents survive as Hitler meant them to, and like others of his papers, they are significant to this narrative. They confirm that the man who had ruled over Germany with an iron hand for more than 12 years, and over most of Europe for 4, had learned nothing from his experience. Not even his reverses and shattering final failure had taught him anything. Indeed, in the last hours of his life, he reverted to the young man he had been in the gutter days in Vienna and in the early rowdy beer hall period in Munich, cursing the Jews for all the ills of the world, spinning his half-baked theories about the universe, and whining that fate once more had cheated Germany of victory and conquest. In this valedictory to the German nation and to the world, which was also meant to be a last, conclusive appeal to history, Adolf Hitler dredged up all the empty claptrap of Mein Kampf and added his final falsehoods. It was a fitting epitaph of a power-drunk tyrant whom absolute power had corrupted absolutely and destroyed. The political testament, as he called it, was divided into two parts, the first consisting of his appeal to posterity, the second of his specific directions for the future. More than 30 years have passed since I made my modest contribution as a volunteer in the First World War, which was forced upon the Reich. In these 3 decades, love and loyalty to my people alone have guided me in all my thoughts, actions, and life. They gave me power to make the most difficult decisions which have ever confronted mortal man. It is untrue that I or anybody else in Germany wanted war in 1939. It was wanted and provoked exclusively by those international statesmen who either were of Jewish origin or worked for Jewish interests. I have made too many offers for the limitation and control of armaments, which posterity will not for all time be able to disregard, for responsibility for the outbreak of this war to be placed on me. Further, I have never wished that after the appalling First World War, there should be a second one against either England or America. Centuries will go by, but from the ruins of our towns and monuments, the hatred of those ultimately responsible will always grow anew. They are the people whom we have to thank for all this, international Jewry and its helpers. Hitler then repeated the lie that 3 days before the attack on Poland he had proposed to the British government a reasonable solution of the Polish-German problem. It was rejected only because the ruling clique in England wanted war, partly for commercial reasons, partly because it was influenced by propaganda put out by the international Jewry. Next he placed sole responsibility not only for the millions of deaths suffered on the battlefields and in the bombed cities, but for his own massacre of the Jews, on the Jews. Then he turned to the reasons for his decision to remain in Berlin to the last. After 6 years of war, which in spite of all setbacks will one day go down in history as the most glorious and heroic manifestation of the struggle for existence of a nation, I cannot forsake the city that is the capital of this state. I wish to share my fate with that which millions of others have also taken upon themselves by staying in this town. Further, I shall not fall in the hands of the enemy, who requires a new spectacle presented by the Jews to divert their hysterical masses. I have therefore decided to remain in Berlin and there to choose death voluntarily at that moment when I believe that the position of the Führer and the Chancellery itself can no longer be maintained. I die with a joyful heart in my knowledge of the immeasurable deeds and achievements of our peasants and workers, and of a contribution unique in history of our youth which bears my name. There followed an exhortation to all Germans not to give up the struggle. He had finally forced himself to recognize, though, that National Socialism was finished for the moment, but he assured his fellow Germans that from the sacrifices of the soldiers and of himself, the seed has been sown that will grow one day to the glorious rebirth of the National Socialist movement of a truly united nation. Hitler could not die without first hurling one last insult at the army, and especially at its officer corps, whom he held chiefly responsible for the disaster. Though he confessed that Nazism was dead, at least for the moment, he nevertheless adjured the commanders of the 3 armed services to strengthen with every possible means the spirit of resistance of our soldiers in the National Socialist belief, with special emphasis on the fact that I myself, as the founder and creator of this movement, prefer death to cowardly resignation or even to capitulation. Then the jibe at the army officer cast. May it be in the future a point of honor with the German army officers, as it already is in our navy, that the surrender of a district or town is out of the question, and that above everything else the commanders must set a shining example of faithful devotion to duty unto death. It was Hitler's insistence that a district or town must be held unto death, as at Stalingrad, which had helped bring about military disaster. But in this, as in other things, he had learned nothing. The second part of the political testament dealt with the question of succession. Though the Third Reich was going up in flames and explosions, Hitler could not bear to die without naming his successor and dictating the exact composition of the government which that successor must appoint. First, he had to eliminate his would-be successors. "Before my death, I expel former Reich Marshal Hermann Göring from the party and withdraw from him all the rights that were conferred on him by the decree of June 20, 1941. In his place, I appoint Admiral Dönitz as President of the Reich and Supreme Commander of the Armed Forces. Before my death, I expel the former Reichsfuhrer of the SS and the Minister of Interior, Heinrich Himmler, from the party and from all his state offices." The leaders of the army, the Air Force, and the SS, he believed, had betrayed him, had cheated him of victory. So his only possible choice of successor had to be the leader of the Navy, which had been too small to play a major role in Hitler's war of conquest. This was a final jibe at the army, which had done most of the fighting and lost most of the men killed in the war. There was also a last parting denunciation of the two men who had been, with Goebbels, his most intimate collaborators since the early days of the party. "Apart altogether from their disloyalty to me, Göring and Himmler have brought irreparable shame on the whole nation by secretly negotiating with the enemy without my knowledge and against my will, and also by illegally attempting to seize control of the state." Having expelled the traitors and named his successor, Hitler then proceeded to tell Dönitz whom he must have in his new government. "They were all honorable men," he said, "who will fulfill the task of continuing the war with all means." Goebbels was to be the chancellor, and Bormann the party minister, a new post. Zeiss Inquart, the Austrian Quisling, and most recently the butcher governor of Holland, was to be foreign minister. Speer, like Ribbentrop, was dropped. But Count Schwerin von Krosigk, who had been Minister of Finance continuously since his appointment by Papen in 1932, was to retain that post. This man was a fool, but it must be admitted that he had a genius for survival. Hitler not only named his successor's government, he imparted one last typical directive to it. "Above all, I enjoin the government and the people to uphold the racial laws to the limit and to resist mercilessly the poisoner of all nations, international Jewry." With that, the supreme German warlord was finished. The time was now 4 a.m. on Sunday, April 29th. Hitler called in Goebbels, Bormann, and Generals Krebs and Bergdorf to witness his signing of the document and to affix their own signatures. He then quickly dictated his personal will. In this, the man of destiny reverted to his lower middle-class origins in Austria, explaining why he had married and why he and his bride were killing themselves, and disposing of his property, which he hoped would be enough to support his surviving relatives in a modest way. At least Hitler had not used his power to amass a vast private fortune, as had Göring. "Although during the years of struggle I believed that I could not undertake the responsibility of marriage, now, before the end of my life, I have decided to take as my wife the woman who, after many years of true friendship, came to this city, already almost besieged, of her own free will in order to share my fate. She will go to her death with me at her own wish as my wife. This will compensate us both for what we lost through my work in the service of my people. My possessions, insofar as they are worth anything, belong to the party, or if this no longer exists, to the state. If the state too is destroyed, there is no need for any further instructions on my part. The paintings in the collection bought by me during the years were never assembled for private purposes, but solely for the establishment of a picture gallery in my hometown of Linz on the Danube." Bormann, as executor, was asked to hand over to my relatives everything that is of value as a personal memento or is necessary for maintaining a petty bourgeois, kleinen bürgerlichen, standard of living. Who these relatives were, Hitler did not say, but from what he told his secretaries, he had in mind his sister, Paula, and his mother-in-law. "My wife and I choose to die in order to escape the shame of overthrow or capitulation. It is our wish that our bodies be burned immediately in the place where I have performed the greater part of my daily work during the 12 years of service to my people." Exhausted by the dictation of his farewell messages, Hitler went to bed as dawn was breaking over Berlin on this last Sabbath of his life. A pall of smoke hung over the city. Buildings crashed in flames as the Russians fired their artillery at point-blank range. They were now not far from the Wilhelmstrasse and the Chancellery. While Hitler slept, Goebbels and Bormann made haste. In his political testament, which they had signed as witnesses, the Führer had specifically ordered them to leave the capital and join the new government. Bormann was more than willing to obey. For all his devotion to the leader, he did not intend to share his death if he could avoid it. The only thing in life he wanted was power behind the scenes, and Dönitz might still offer him this. That is, if Göring, on learning of the Führer's death, did not try to usurp the throne. To make sure that he did not, Bormann now got out a radio message to the SS headquarters at Berchtesgaden. "If Berlin and we should fall, the traitors of April 23rd must be exterminated. Men, do your duty. Your life and honor depend on it." This was an order to murder Göring and his Air Force staff, whom Bormann had already placed under SS arrest. Dr. Goebbels, like Eva Braun, but unlike Bormann, had no desire to live in a Germany from which his revered Führer had departed. He had hitched his star to Hitler, to whom alone he owed his sensational rise in life. He had been the chief prophet and propagandist of the Nazi movement. It was he who, next to Hitler, had created its myths. To perpetuate those myths, not only the leader, but his most loyal follower, the only one of the old guard who had not betrayed him, must die a sacrificial death. He too must give an example that would be remembered down the ages and help one day to rekindle the fires of National Socialism. Such seemed to have been his thoughts when, after Hitler retired, Goebbels repaired to his little room in the bunker to write his own valedictory to present and future generations. He entitled it "Appendix to the Führer's Political Testament." "The Führer has ordered me to leave Berlin and take part as a leading member in the government appointed by him. For the first time in my life, I must categorically refuse to obey an order of the Führer. My wife and children join me in this refusal. Apart from the fact that feelings of humanity and personal loyalty forbid us to abandon the Führer in his hour of greatest need, I would otherwise appear for the rest of my life as a dishonorable traitor and a common scoundrel, and would lose my self-respect as well as the respect of my fellow citizens. In the nightmare of treason which surrounds the Führer in these most critical days of the war, there must be someone at least who will stay with him unconditionally until death. I believe I am thereby doing the best service to the future of the German people. In the hard times to come, examples will be more important than men. For this reason, together with my wife and on behalf of my children, who are too young to be able to speak for themselves and who, if they were old enough, would unreservedly agree with this decision, I express my unalterable resolution not to leave the Reich capital, even if it falls, but rather at the side of the Führer, to end a life that for me personally will have no further value if I cannot spend it at the service of the Führer and at his side." Dr. Goebbels finished writing his piece at 5:30 on the morning of April 29th. Daylight was breaking over Berlin, but the sun was obscured by the smoke of battle. In the electric light of the bunker, much remained to be done. The first consideration was how to get the Führer's last will and testament out through the nearby Russian lines, so that it could be delivered to Dönitz and others and preserved for posterity. 3 messengers were chosen to take copies of the precious documents out. Major Willy Johannmeier, Hitler's military adjutant, Wilhelm Zander, an SS officer and advisor to Bormann, and Heinz Lorenz, the propaganda ministry official who had brought the shattering news of Himmler's treachery the night before. Johannmeier, a much decorated officer, was to lead the party through the Red Army's lines. He himself was then to deliver his copy of the papers to Field Marshal Ferdinand Schirner, whose army group still held out intact in the Bohemian Mountains, and whom Hitler had named as the new commander-in-chief of the army. General Bergdorf enclosed a covering letter informing Schirner that Hitler had written his testament today under the shattering news of Himmler's treachery. It is his unalterable decision. Zander and Lorenz were to take their copies to Dönitz. Zander was given a covering note from Bormann. "Dear Grand Admiral, since all divisions have failed to arrive and our position seems hopeless, The Führer dictated last night the attached political testament. Heil Hitler. The three messengers set out on their dangerous mission at noon, edging their way westward through the Tiergarten and Charlottenburg to Pickelsdorf at the head of the Havel Lake, where a Hitler youth battalion held the bridge in anticipation of the arrival of Wenck's Ghost Army. To get that far, they had successfully slipped through three Russian rings, at the Victory Column in the middle of the Tiergarten, at the zoo station just beyond the park, and on the approaches to Pickelsdorf. They still had many other lines to penetrate, and much adventure lay ahead of them, and though they eventually got through, it was much too late for their messages to be of any use to Dönitz and Schirner, who never saw them. Trevor Roper, in The Last Days of Hitler, has given a graphic account of their adventures. But for an indiscretion of Heinz Lorenz, the farewell messages of Hitler and Goebbels might never have become known. Major Johann Meyer eventually buried his copy of the documents in the garden of his home at Iserlohn in Westphalia. Zander hid his copy in a trunk which he left in the Bavarian village of Tegernsee. Changing his name and assuming a disguise, he attempted to begin a new life under the name of Wilhelm Pausten. But Lorenz, a journalist by profession, was too garrulous to keep his secret very well, and a chance indiscretion led to the discovery of his copy and to the exposure of the other two messengers. The three messengers were not the only persons to depart from the bunker that day. At noon on April 29th, Hitler, who had now been restored to a period of calm, held his customary war conference to discuss the military situation, just as he had daily at this hour for nearly 6 years, and just as if the end of the road had not been reached. General Krebs reported that the Russians had advanced farther toward the Chancellery during the night and early morning. The supply of ammunition of the city's defenders, such as they were, was getting low. There was still no news from Wenck's rescue army. Three military adjutants, who now found little to do and who did not want to join the leader in self-inflicted death, asked if they could leave the bunker in order to try to find out what had happened to Wenck. Hitler granted them permission and instructed them to urge General Wenck to get a move on. During the afternoon, the three officers left. They were soon joined by a fourth, Colonel Nikolaus von Below, Hitler's Luftwaffe adjutant, who had been a junior member of the inner circle since the beginning of the war. Below, too, did not believe in suicide and felt that there was no longer any useful employment in the Chancellery shelter. He asked the permission of the Führer to leave, and it was granted. Hitler was being most reasonable this day. It also occurred to him that he could utilize the Air Force colonel to carry out one last message. This was to be to General Keitel, whom Bormann already suspected of treason, and it would contain the warlord's final blast at the army, which, he felt, had let him down. No doubt the news at the evening situation conference at 10 p.m. increased the Führer's already monumental bitterness at the army. General Weidling, who commanded the courageous but ragged overage Volkssturm and underage Hitler Youth troops being sacrificed in encircled Berlin to prolong Hitler's life a few days, reported that the Russians had pushed ahead along the Saarlandstrasse and the Wilhelmstrasse almost to the Air Ministry, which was only a stone's throw from the Chancellery. The enemy would reach the Chancellery, he said, by May 1st at the latest, in a day or two, that is. This was the end. Even Hitler, who up until now had been directing non-existent armies supposed to be coming to the relief of the capital, saw that, at last. He dictated his final message and asked Below to deliver it to Keitel. He informed his chief of OKW that the defense of Berlin was now at an end, that he was killing himself rather than surrender, that Goering and Himmler had betrayed him, and that he had named Admiral Dönitz as his successor. He had one last word to say about the armed forces, which, despite his leadership, had brought Germany to defeat. The Navy, he said, had performed superbly. The Luftwaffe had fought bravely, and only Goering was responsible for its losing its initial supremacy in the war. As for the army, the common soldiers had fought well and courageously, but the generals had failed them and him. The people and the armed forces, he continued, have given their all in this long and hard struggle. The sacrifice has been enormous, but my trust has been misused by many people. Disloyalty and betrayal have undermined resistance throughout the war. It was therefore not granted to me to lead the people to victory. The Army General Staff cannot be compared with the General Staff in the First World War. Its achievements were far behind those of the fighting front. At least the supreme Nazi warlord was remaining true to character to the very end. The great victories had been due to him. The defeats and final failure had been due to others, to their disloyalty and betrayal. And then the parting valediction, the last recorded written words of this mad genius's life. The efforts and sacrifices of the German people in this war have been so great that I cannot believe that they have been in vain. The aim must still be to win territory in the East for the German people. Colonel Below destroyed the message when he learned of Hitler's death while he was still making his way toward the Allied Western armies. He has reconstructed it from memory. See Trevor Roper, already cited, pages 194 to 195. The last sentence was straight out of Mein Kampf. Hitler had begun his political life with the obsession that territory in the East must be won for the favored German people, and he was ending his life with it. All the millions of German dead, all the millions of German homes crushed under the bombs, even the destruction of the German nation had not convinced him that the robbing of the lands of the Slavic peoples to the East was, morals aside, a futile Teutonic dream. The death of Hitler and his bride. During the afternoon of April 29th, one of the last pieces of news to reach the bunker from the outside world came in. Mussolini, Hitler's fellow fascist dictator and partner in aggression, had met his end, and it had been shared by his mistress, Clara Petacci. They had been caught by Italian partisans on April 27th while trying to escape from Como into Switzerland, and executed 2 days later. On the Saturday night of April 28th, the bodies were brought to Milan in a truck and dumped on the piazza. The next day, they were strung up by the heels from lampposts and later cut down so that throughout the rest of the Sabbath day they lay in the gutter, where vengeful Italians reviled them. On May Day, Benito Mussolini was buried beside his mistress in the pauper's plot in the Cimitero Maggiore in Milan. In such a macabre climax of degradation, Il Duce and fascism passed into history. It is not known how many of the details of the Duce's shabby end were communicated to the Führer. One can only speculate that if he heard many of them, he was only strengthened in his resolve not to allow himself or his bride to be made a spectacle presented by the Jews to divert their hysterical masses, as he had just written in his testament, not their live selves or their bodies. Shortly after receiving the news of Mussolini's death, Hitler began to make the final preparations for his. He had his favorite Alsatian dog, Blondie, poisoned, and two other dogs in the household shot. Then he called in his two remaining women secretaries and handed them capsules of poison to use if they wished to when the barbarian Russians broke in. He was sorry, he said, not to be able to give them a better farewell gift, and he expressed his appreciation for their long and loyal service. Evening had now come, the last of Adolf Hitler's life. He instructed Frau Junge, one of his secretaries, to destroy the remaining papers in his files, and he sent out word that no one in the bunker was to go to bed until further orders. This was interpreted by all as meaning that he judged the time had come to make his farewells. But it was not until long after midnight, at about 2:30 a.m. of April 30th, as several witnesses recall, that the Führer emerged from his private quarters and appeared in the general dining passage, where some 20 persons, mostly the women members of his entourage, were assembled. He walked down the line, shaking hands with each and mumbling a few words that were inaudible. There was a heavy film of moisture on his eyes, and, as Frau Junge remembered, they seemed to be looking far away, beyond the walls of the bunker. After he retired, a curious thing happened. The tension which had been building up to an almost unendurable point in the bunker broke, and several persons went to the canteen, to dance. The weird party soon became so noisy that word was sent from the Führer's quarters requesting more quiet. The Russians might come in a few hours and kill them all, though most of them were already thinking of how they could escape. But in the meantime, for a brief spell, now that the Führer's strict control of their lives was over, they would seek pleasure where and how they could find it. The sense of relief among these people seems to have been enormous, and they danced on through the night. Not Bormann. This murky man still had work to do. His own prospects for survival seemed to be diminishing. There might not be a long enough interval between the Führer's death and the arrival of the Russians in which he could escape to Dönitz. If not, While the Führer still lived and thus clothed his orders with authority, Bormann could at least exact further revenge on the traitors. He dispatched during this last night a further message to Dönitz. Dönitz, our impression grows daily stronger that the divisions in the Berlin theater have been standing idle for several days. All the reports we receive are controlled, suppressed, or distorted by Keitel. The Führer orders you to proceed at once and mercilessly against all traitors. And then, though he knew that Hitler's death was only hours away, he added a postscript. The Führer is alive and is conducting the defense of Berlin. But Berlin was no longer defensible. The Russians already had occupied almost all of the city. It was now merely a question of the defense of the Chancellery. It, too, was doomed, as Hitler and Bormann learned at the Situation Conference at noon on April 30th, the last that was ever to take place. The Russians had reached the eastern end of the Tiergarten and broken into the Potsdamer Platz. They were just a block away. The hour for Adolf Hitler to carry out his resolve had come. His bride apparently had no appetite for lunch that day, and Hitler took his repast with his two secretaries and with his vegetarian cook, who perhaps did not realize that she had prepared his last meal. While they were finishing their lunch at about 2:30 p.m., Erich Kempke, the Führer's chauffeur, who was in charge of the Chancellery garage, received an order to deliver immediately 200 liters of gasoline in jerry cans to the Chancellery garden. Kempke had some difficulty in rounding up so much fuel, but he managed to collect some 180 liters, and with the help of three men carried it to the emergency exit of the bunker. While the oil to provide the fire for the Viking funeral was being collected, Hitler, having done with his last meal, fetched Eva Braun for another and final farewell to his most intimate collaborators, Dr. Goebbels, Generals Krebs and Bergdorf, the secretaries and Fräulein Manziali, the cook. Frau Goebbels did not appear. This formidable and beautiful blonde woman had, like Eva Braun, found it easy to make the decision to die with her husband, but the prospect of killing her six young children, who had been playing merrily in the underground shelter these last days without an inkling of what was in store for them, unnerved her. "My dear Hanna," she had said to Fräulein Reitsch two or three evenings before, "when the end comes, you must help me if I become weak about the children. They belong to the Third Reich and to the Führer. And if these two cease to exist, there can be no further place for them. My greatest fear is that at the last moment I will be too weak." Alone in her little room, she was now striving to overcome her greatest fear. The children and their ages were Hela, 12, Hilda, 11, Helmut, 9, Hulda, 7, Hedda, 5, Heida, 3. Hitler and Eva Braun had no such problem. They had only their own lives to take. They finished their farewells and retired to their rooms. Outside in the passageway, Dr. Goebbels, Bormann, and a few others waited. In a few moments, a revolver shot was heard. They waited for a second one, but there was only silence. After a decent interval, they quietly entered the Führer's quarters. They found the body of Adolf Hitler sprawled on the sofa, dripping blood. He had shot himself in the mouth. At his side lay Eva Braun. Two revolvers had tumbled to the floor, but the bride had not used hers. She had swallowed poison. It was 3:30 p.m. on Monday, April 30th, 1945, 10 days after Adolf Hitler's 56th birthday, and 12 years and 3 months to a day since he had become Chancellor of Germany and had instituted the Third Reich. It would survive him but a week. The Viking funeral followed. There were no words spoken. The only sound was the roar of Russian shells exploding in the garden of the Chancellery and on the shattered walls around it. Hitler's valet, SS-Sturmbannführer Heinz Linge, and an orderly carried out the Führer's body, wrapped in an army field-gray blanket, which concealed the shattered face. Kempke identified it in his own mind by the black trousers and shoes which protruded from the blanket and which the warlord always wore with his field-gray jacket. Eva Braun's death had been cleaner, there was no blood, and Bormann carried out her body just as it was to the passage, where he turned it over to Kempke. "Frau Hitler," the chauffeur later recounted, "wore a dark dress. I could not recognize any injuries to the body." The corpses were carried up to the garden and, during a lull in the bombardment, placed in a shell hole and ignited with gasoline. The mourners, headed by Goebbels and Bormann, withdrew to the shelter of the emergency exit, and as the flames mounted, stood at attention and raised their right hands in a farewell Nazi salute. It was a brief ceremony, for Red Army shells began to spatter the garden again, and the survivors retired to the safety of the bunker, leaving the gasoline-fed flames to complete the work of eradicating the last earthly remains of Adolf Hitler and his wife. The bones were never found, and this gave rise to rumors after the war that Hitler had survived. But the separate interrogation of several eyewitnesses by British and American intelligence officers leaves no doubt about the matter. Kempke has given a plausible explanation as to why the charred bones were never found. "The traces were wiped out," he told his interrogators, "by the uninterrupted Russian artillery fire." For Bormann and Goebbels, there were still tasks to perform in the Third Reich, now bereft of its founder and dictator, though they were not the same tasks. There had not yet been time for the messengers to reach Dönitz with the Führer's testament appointing him as his successor. The admiral would now have to be informed by radio. But even at this point, with power slipped from his hands, Bormann hesitated. It was difficult to one who had savored it to give it up so abruptly. Finally, he got off a message. "Grand Admiral Dönitz, in place of the former Reich Marshal Göring, the Führer appoints you as his successor. Written authority is on its way. You will immediately take all such measures as the situation requires." There was not a word that Hitler was dead. The admiral, who was in command of all German forces in the north and had moved his headquarters to Plön in Schleswig, was flabbergasted at the news. Unlike the party leaders, he had no desire to succeed Hitler. The thought had never entered his sailor's head. 2 days before, believing that Himmler would inherit the succession, he had gone to the SS chief and offered him his support. But since it would never have occurred to him to disobey an order of the Führer, he sent the following reply in the belief that Adolf Hitler was still alive. "My Führer, my loyalty to you will be unconditional. I shall do everything possible to relieve you in Berlin. If fate nevertheless compels me to rule the Reich as your appointed successor, I shall continue this war to an end worthy of the unique heroic struggle of the German people. Grand Admiral Dönitz." That night, Bormann and Goebbels had a fresh idea. They decided to try to negotiate with the Russians. General Krebs, the chief of the Army General Staff, who had remained in the bunker, had once been the assistant military attaché in Moscow, spoke Russian, and on one famous occasion had even been embraced by Stalin at the Moscow railway station. Perhaps he could get something out of the Bolsheviks. Specifically, what Goebbels and Bormann wanted was a safe conduct for themselves so that they could take their appointed places in the new Dönitz government. In return for this, they were prepared to surrender Berlin. General Krebs set out shortly after midnight of April 30th to May 1st to see General Chuikov, not Marshal Zhukov, as most accounts have had it, the Soviet commander of the troops fighting in Berlin. One of the German officers accompanying him has recorded the opening of their conversation. "Krebs, today is the 1st of May, a great holiday for our two nations." May 1st was the traditional Labor Day in Europe. Chuikov: "We have a great holiday today. How things are with you over there is hard to say." The Russian general demanded the unconditional surrender of everyone in the Führer's bunker, as well as of the remaining German troops in Berlin. It took Krebs some time to carry out his mission, and when he had not returned by 11 a.m. on May 1st, the impatient Bormann dispatched another radio message to Dönitz. "The testament is in force. I will join you as soon as possible. Till then, I recommend that publication be held up." This was still ambiguous. Bormann simply could not be straightforward enough to say that the Führer was dead. He wanted to get out to be the first to inform Dönitz of the momentous news and thereby help to ensure his favor with the new commander-in-chief. But Goebbels, who with his wife and children was about to die, had no such reason for not telling the admiral the simple truth. At 3:15 p.m. he got off his own message to Dönitz, the last radio communication ever to leave the beleaguered bunker in Berlin. "Grand Admiral Dönitz, most secret. The Führer died yesterday at 15:30 hours, 3:30 p.m. Testament of April 29th appoints you as Reich President." There follow the names of the principal cabinet appointments. "By order of the Führer, the testament has been sent out of Berlin to you. Bormann intends to go to you today and to inform you of the situation. Time and form of announcement to the press and to the troops is left to you. Confirm receipt. Goebbels." Goebbels did not think it necessary to inform the new leader of his own intentions. Early in the evening of May 1st, he carried them out. The first act was to poison the six children. Their playing was halted, and they were given lethal injections, apparently by the same physician who the day before had poisoned the Führer's dogs. Then Goebbels called his adjutant, SS Hauptsturmfuhrer Günther Schwegermann, and instructed him to fetch some gasoline. "Schwegermann," he told him, "this is the worst treachery of all. The generals have betrayed the Führer. Everything is lost. I shall die, together with my wife and family." He did not mention, even to his adjutant, that he had just had his children murdered. "You will burn our bodies. Can you do that?" Schwegermann assured him that he could, and sent two orderlies to procure the gasoline. A few minutes later, at about 8:30 p.m., just as it was getting dark outside, Dr. and Frau Goebbels walked through the bunker, bade goodbye to those who happened to be in the corridor, and mounted the stairs to the garden. There, at their request, an SS orderly dispatched them with two shots in the back of the head. Four cans of gasoline were poured over their bodies and set on fire, but the cremation was not well done. The survivors in the bunker were anxious to join the mass escape, which was just getting underway, and there was no time to waste on burning those already dead. The Russians found the charred bodies of the propaganda minister and his wife the next day and immediately identified them. By 9 o'clock on the evening of May 1st, the Führer bunker had been set on fire, and some 500 or 600 survivors of the Führer's entourage, mostly SS men, were milling about in the shelter of the new chancellery, like chickens with their heads off, as one of them, the Führer's tailor, later recalled, preparatory to the great breakout. The plan was to go by foot along the subway tracks from the station below the Wilhelmplatz, opposite the chancellery, to the Friedrichstrasse Bahnhof, and there cross the river Spree and sift through the Russian lines immediately to the north of it. A good many got through. Some did not, among them Martin Bormann. When General Krebs had finally returned to the bunker that afternoon with General Trikov's demand for unconditional surrender, Hitler's party secretary had decided that his only chance for survival lay in joining the mass exodus. His group attempted to follow a German tank, but according to Kempke, who was with him, it received a direct hit from a Russian shell, and Bormann was almost certainly killed. Artur Axmann, the Hitler youth leader who had deserted his battalion of boys at the Pickelsdorf Bridge to save his neck, was also present and later deposed that he had seen Bormann's body lying under the bridge where the Invalidenstrasse crosses the railroad tracks. There was moonlight on his face, and Axmann could see no sign of wounds. His presumption was that Bormann had swallowed his capsule of poison when he saw that his chances of getting through the Russian lines were nil. Generals Krebs and Bergdorf did not join in the mass attempt to escape. It is believed that they shot themselves in the cellar of the new chancellery. The end of the Third Reich. The Third Reich survived the death of its founder by 7 days. A little after 10 o'clock on the evening of the 1st of May, while the bodies of Dr. and Frau Goebbels were burning in the Chancellery Garden and the inhabitants of the bunker were herding together for their escape through a subway tunnel in Berlin, the Hamburg radio interrupted the playing of a recording of Bruckner's solemn Seventh Symphony. There was a roll of military drums, and then an announcer spoke. "Our Führer, Adolf Hitler, fighting to the last breath against Bolshevism, fell for Germany this afternoon in his operational headquarters in the Reich Chancellery. On April 30th, the Führer appointed Grand Admiral Dönitz his successor. The Grand Admiral and successor of the Führer now speaks to the German people." The Third Reich was expiring as it had begun, with a shabby lie. Aside from the fact that Hitler had not died that afternoon but the previous one, which was not important, he had not fallen fighting to the last breath, but the broadcasting of this falsehood was necessary if the inheritors of his mantle were to perpetuate a legend, and also if they were to hold control of the troops who were still offering resistance and who would surely have felt betrayed if they had known the truth. Dönitz himself repeated the lie when he went on the air at 10:20 p.m. and spoke of the hero's death of the Führer. Actually, at that moment, he did not know how Hitler had met his end. Goebbels had radioed only that he had died on the previous afternoon. But this did not inhibit the Admiral either on this point or on others, for he did his best to muddy the confused minds of the German people in the hour of their disaster. "It is my first task," he said, "to save Germany from destruction by the advancing Bolshevik enemy. For this aim alone the military struggle continues. As far and as long as the achievement of this aim is impeded by the British and Americans, we shall be forced to carry on our defensive fight against them as well. Under such conditions, however, The Anglo-Americans will continue the war not for their own peoples, but solely for the spreading of Bolshevism in Europe. After this silly distortion, the admiral, who is not recorded as having protested Hitler's decision to make the Bolshevik nation Germany's ally in 1939, so that a war could be fought against England and later America, assured the German people in concluding his broadcast that God will not forsake us after so much suffering and sacrifice. These were empty words. Dönitz knew that German resistance was at an end. On April 29th, the day before Hitler took his life, the German armies in Italy had surrendered unconditionally, an event whose news, because of the breakdown in communications, was spared the Führer, which must have made his last hours more bearable than they otherwise would have been. On May 4th, the German High Command surrendered to Montgomery all German forces in northwest Germany, Denmark, and Holland. The next day, Kesselring's Army Group G, comprising the German 1st and 19th Armies north of the Alps, capitulated. On that day, May 5th, Admiral Hans von Friedeberg, the new commander-in-chief of the German Navy, arrived at General Eisenhower's headquarters at Reims to negotiate a surrender. The German aim, as the last papers of OKW make clear, was to stall for a few days in order to have time to move as many German troops and refugees as possible from the path of the Russians, so that they could surrender to the Western Allies. General Jodl arrived at Reims the next day to help his Navy colleague draw out the proceedings. But it was in vain. Eisenhower saw through the game. "I told General Smith," he later recounted, "to inform Jodl that unless they instantly ceased all pretense and delay, I would close the entire Allied front, and would, by force, prevent any more German refugees from entering our lines. I would brook no further delay." At 1:30 a.m. on May 7th, Dönitz, after being informed by Jodl of Eisenhower's demands, radioed the German general from his new headquarters at Flensburg on the Danish frontier, full powers to sign the document of unconditional surrender. The game was up. In a little red schoolhouse at Reims, where Eisenhower had made his headquarters, Germany surrendered unconditionally at 2:41 on the morning of May 7th, 1945. The capitulation was signed for the Allies by General Walter Bedell Smith, with General Ivan Suslopirov affixing his signature as witness for Russia and General François Sivet for France. Admiral Friedeberg and General Jodl signed for Germany. Jodl asked permission to say a word, and it was granted. "With this signature, the German people and the German armed forces are, for better or worse, delivered into the hands of the victors. In this hour I can only express the hope that the victor will treat them with generosity." There was no response from the Allied side, but perhaps Jodl recalled another occasion when the roles were reversed just 5 years before. Then a French general, in signing France's unconditional surrender at Compiègne, had made a similar plea, in vain, as it turned out. The guns in Europe ceased firing and the bombs ceased dropping at midnight on May 8th to 9th, 1945, and a strange but welcome silence settled over the continent for the first time since September 1st, 1939. In the intervening 5 years, 8 months, and 7 days, millions of men and women had been slaughtered on 100 battlefields and in 1,000 bombed towns, and millions more done to death in the Nazi gas chambers or on the edge of the SS Einsatzgruppen pits in Russia and Poland, as the result of Adolf Hitler's lust for German conquest. A greater part of most of Europe's ancient cities lay in ruins, and from their rubble, as the weather warmed, there was the stench of the countless unburied dead. No more would the streets of Germany echo to the jackboot of the goose-stepping stormtroopers, or the lusty yells of the brown-shirted masses, or the shouts of the Führer blaring from the loudspeakers. After 12 years, 4 months, and 8 days, an age of darkness to all but a multitude of Germans, and now ending in a bleak night for them too, the thousand-year Reich had come to an end. It had raised, as we have seen, this great nation and this resourceful but so easily misled people to heights of power and conquest they had never before experienced, and now it had dissolved with a suddenness and a completeness that had few, if any, parallels in history. In 1918, after the last defeat, the Kaiser had fled, the monarchy had tumbled, but the other traditional institutions supporting the state had remained. A government chosen by the people had continued to function, as did the nucleus of a German army under General Staff. But in the spring of 1945, the Third Reich simply ceased to exist. There was no longer any German authority on any level. The millions of soldiers, airmen, and sailors were prisoners of war in their own land. The millions of civilians were governed down to the villages by the conquering enemy troops, on whom they depended not only for law and order, but throughout that summer and bitter winter of 1945 for food and fuel to keep them alive. Such was the state to which the follies of Adolf Hitler, and their own folly in following him so blindly and with so much enthusiasm, had brought them, though I found little bitterness toward him when I returned to Germany that fall. The people were there, and the land. The first, dazed and bleeding and hungry, and when winter came, shivering in their rags in the hovels which the bombings had made of their homes. The second, a vast wasteland of rubble. The German people had not been destroyed, as Hitler, who had tried to destroy so many other peoples and, in the end, when the war was lost, themselves, had wished. But the Third Reich had passed into history.